Well, thank you so much, Larry, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. You're my 46th guest. How are you today? Thanks so much for joining me.
I'm good. Happy to be with you.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you as well. You're a former ESPN anchor, and you've been with ABC7 up in San Francisco for over 20 years now, I think 22 to be exact, and went to the University of Hawaii. You were very much involved in the journalism at your campus radio station, your student newspaper, you know, in that type of journalistic environment. We'd love to know your definition of relationship building in a team environment. What does relationship building mean to Larry Beal?
Well, I think it's super important, and it's probably one of those things that gets overlooked. I mean, if you look at somebody's resume, you know, whatever they put down, I did this, I did that, I did this, I did that. But I really think it's the personal connections that you have along the way. And I have two daughters who are in their 20s, and we've been talking about this for years and years and years, whether high school, college, your postgraduate degree, whatever it is that you're shooting for. The idea is to build out your own personal network of contacts, and that'll serve you well in a variety of ways. You know, for one thing, you know, you'll be connected with people probably for many, many years. You also may be, assuming you have good relationships with them, which is the goal, obviously. But, you know, also, you know, I used to joke with my daughters, you know, when they were going to UC Santa Barbara, and the idea that, you know, you don't have to be the person that invents Google or invents Facebook, whatever it is. But if you happen to be sitting three desks over from that person, then these are relationships down the road that might serve you well, not only just professionally, but personally as well, to try to, you know, find people that you're comfortable with that have the same values that you do. And, you know, you can progress through life, you know, along with them.
That's wonderful advice. And I'm so glad that you, as a father, and I'm a father as well, you know, you take a very active approach and stance with respect to, you know, making sure that your daughters, as they are in their college years or at the time you were speaking with them, that's great that you put it in perspective that they don't have to be like everybody else. They could carve their own path, make their own identity, figure out what major will work for them, or, you know, really in an exploratory fashion, just ask a lot of questions, see who else is in your classes, talk to them, see what their interests are. And, you know, life evolves even from the college days. They're going to, once they graduate from college, they're going to be really in their first positions. They're going to be really starting to figure out what they like and what they don't like.
Sure.
You know, when you think back to, you know, your time in college at the University of Hawaii, talk to me about those early days. What drew you to journalism? Do you come from a journalism family? What was it about communications that really piqued your interest?
Well, when I was going to the University of Hawaii, you know, we were still dodging dinosaurs that were flying over our heads. So that's how long ago it was. But, you know, look, like many of us growing up, you know, my first goal would have been to play point guard for the Lakers or tailback for the Cowboys. But Magic Johnson and Tony Dorsett seemed to have that pretty well handled, and my services were not required at that point. So I figured, look, if I can't do it, the next best thing would be talking about it, since, you know, I'm going to watch all these playoff games in the NBA anyway. I might as well get paid if it's possible to do it at a level that's proficient enough. So that's really what drew me, you know, to that. You know, my father was involved in broadcasting, but we really didn't, you know, have a close relationship. So I was able to forge my own path. And the cool thing about even going back to the University of Hawaii, I still am in touch with the first editor that I had, who was like my copy editor when I first started writing columns. And we're talking, you know, literally decades ago. And he and I are still friends. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, I always joke with him about what a tyrant he was and an impossible boss he was, changing all of my copy around. But, you know, it just shows you, I mean, the relationships that you build at a young age can last literally decades and decades and decades.
Well, that's wonderful that you still keep in touch with him. And, you know, you see how his career has progressed. What has he been up to in terms of, you know, how did his career unfold, and have you been observing it from afar?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been writing for, you know, the major newspaper in Honolulu for many, many years. And so he's probably the number one writer, columnist for what is now the Honolulu Star Advertiser. And so he stayed on the print side, and now he's dabbling in some broadcast stuff as well. You know, I just went more broadcast than print. And so sometime down the road, I'm sure our paths will cross on a professional basis. But right now he's in Hawaii, I'm in California. So we haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, of course. So at least you're only a 6-hour plane ride. I know that sounds like a lot, but it's definitely manageable. Hopefully you guys can reconnect, and that would be a great little reunion. When you think about your time at ESPN, you joined back in 1995, and I mean, that was just a year removed from the advent of the internet, right? I mean, like SportsCenter and, I mean, ESPN was so different back in the 90s, but so nostalgic or iconic, really. I mean, you got to work with Dan Patrick, Robin Roberts, Keith Olbermann, to name some of the people who you worked with, Rich Eisen. What has it been like now that you have seen, you know, ESPN evolve since the time that you were there?
Well, it's kind of like a totally different company from the old days. Somebody had just asked me for a photo, and it was, I think there was like 11 or 12 of us, including some of the people that you mentioned, the late Stuart Scott, Reese Davis. Reese Davis and I actually started on the same exact day. It was April Fool's Day, ironically. And Reese is still there going strong. And I'm really happy for him and the success that he's had. But, you know, now, I mean, there's so many channels. There's, you know, people don't even realize that ESPN has this whole international branch that in some ways is more impressive than what they do in the United States. But that's a whole other topic of discussion. What's nice is that, you know, Robin was in San Francisco a few weeks ago. We narrowly missed each other. But, you know, we're just like, where are you going to be? Where are you going to that kind of thing? And, you know, you're trying to intersect. Everybody's got such busy schedules that, you know, sometimes it's hard. And, you know, she's really, you know, at the top of her field. So her schedule is really tight on a daily basis. But, you know, I look back at those days fondly, and still are really good friends with, you know, a lot of the folks that we work with in front of the camera, behind the scenes. I was just talking to Neil Everett the other day, and he and I share the Hawaii connection. And so, you know, a lot of really, really talented people, and had a great time working with so many of them. And it's cool if you feel like you're working with the people who are at the top of their profession. One of the guys that that left shortly after I arrived, and he was great, his name's Tim Kiley. And he's the executive producer of all of the Inside the NBA shows with Charles and Shaq and Kenny and Ernie. And, you know, I think about him all the time just because I can see his imprint on the shows, you know, even going back to the days that we worked together. So, you come across, you meet some really, really gifted people. And I think that's one of the best things about the job.
And when you think about the relationships that you made when you were there and working with the people that you and I have mentioned, how special has it been for you to still remain in contact with them, or just remember those times and those, I'm sure you have stories, and I'm sure you think fondly of those 6 years. Care to share with me just things that stand out or continue to stand out even since your time there?
There's so many stories and things that, like, just memorable things that happened. I mean, one of the first snowstorms that I remember coming out to my car at like 3 o'clock in the morning because I was doing the late show at that point. Mm-hmm. And my car was enveloped in basically a sheet of ice. And I literally was just standing in the parking lot going, all right, how do I get into this? I started chipping away. I must have been out there for an hour, and I really wanted to go in and just ask like a security guard, like, help me here. What do I do with this? And it took me so long just to get into the car. But so I learned a lot about freezing rain and snow and that sort of thing. But also, you know, man, the stuff that we did back then, it's proved to be invaluable in terms of just learning the craft. And a lot of the people at ESPN then and now, it's almost like a SWAT team of sports. I mean, they're like real professionals, the elite of the elite. And so, you know, you can't help but get better. You're going to get better. You get more reps. And, you know, I'll never forget just watching Mike Tirico work and, you know, following him and doing a lot of the shows that he ended up doing after, as he, you know, moved up the ladder. Sure. And just marveling at his skill level and going, oh my God, I'm going to have to do this after he leaves. Then it's a terrible thing to have to follow him because like he doesn't, like, I think he'll go like weeks without making a mistake. Right. So it's hard, you know, it's hard. Some of these people are really like Keith Olbermann. You know, I joke with Keith, if he, you know, years ago, he was really more into baseball and the sports stuff, and now really much more into politics, but he's so smart. If he had decided that he wanted to spend his life just devoting his brains for a cure for cancer, he would have figured it out by now. Like, he's that smart. So you meet people that are really, really talented, and you know, it's fun just thinking. He's the fastest one finger typist I've ever seen. Just these just little idiosyncrasies from people that, you know, you wouldn't even think about, but, you know, are in my mind all these years later.
Well, and, you know, and he is someone who can talk sports or talk politics. You can tell that he's well versed and he researches a lot and he's knowledgeable. And for someone like you coming from the ESPN world, and, you know, I worked with, you know, Reese Davis, and I remember getting caught in some of those snowstorms too. And, you know, it's just amazing. You know, I think fondly, I, you know, met the late, great Stuart Scott. He and I are Chapel Hill alumni. I worked with, you know, Lou Holtz and Mark May and Jesse Palmer and John Saunders, and just a lot of people who have even been at the network, you know, maybe just only in the last 10 to 15 years and even further back than that. I mean, I was close to Barry Sachs, who just recently passed away.
Yeah,
a long time sad. Coordinating producer. Yes, it was very, very sad. And I just think about all the people past and present who are still there. And, you know, I'm proud to be part of the, you know, alumni of ESPN and, you know, still keep in touch with a lot of people and like connecting with new people like yourself and who I haven't had the privilege of working with before or pleasure of meeting before. So it's great to have this podcast where I can connect with people who had also had worked at ESPN at one time or another. When you think of going back into local news, and I know having done my research, as you alluded to earlier, you wanted to come back home and work in the Bay Area. What was that transition like coming back into local news, and what have you enjoyed about local news since your time at ESPN?
It's obviously a big transition. You know, when you think of the staffing at ESPN, you know, you have researchers, you have people that you can go to for a variety of things. Now I suppose we have ChatGPT-4. So, you know, just ask AI what, you know, what the stat is. But, you know, more seriously, you know, local news is a challenge these days because, you know, everybody can just get their information on one of these phones and they don't necessarily have to stay up. It's not appointment viewing, you know, at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, that kind of thing. The thing that I really do enjoy that I didn't get a chance to do a lot at ESPN is that, you know, like I was mentioning to you, on a daily or a nightly basis, you know, last night I was up in Sacramento watching the Kings play the Warriors. And so if I walked into the Warriors locker room, I could just walk around and hi to Steph, hi to Clay, hi to, you know, having the personal interaction with people as opposed to being pretty isolated in Bristol, Connecticut, where you might do satellite talkbacks with people, that kind of thing, or radio interviews, but you're not going to see them in person or spend a few minutes with them. And so I think in that regard, it's really been fun. And we've been fortunate in the San Francisco Bay Area to have some great teams. You know, when I first moved back, you know, we had 49ers, Raiders, Giants, A's, you know, Warriors, Sharks, all the college teams. You know, a few of them have gone their separate ways, like the Raiders. We don't know what's going to happen with the A's. But just to be able to have the personal associations with the people from those franchises. And, you know, I think that's been a lot of fun in terms of being at a local, you are at a local level. You get a chance to interact with a lot of these guys, some of them before they're really famous. And, you know, so I think that's been a gratifying part of it. And, you know, we get to do post-game shows. We've been really fortunate because ABC has the NBA Finals. And right. So we've had, you know, all four of the Warriors championship title teams. I was thinking, I'm trying to count how many parades I've actually hosted. It's been a bunch between the Giants. They won three. The A's won a couple way back when. Warriors four recently. We're still waiting on you know, Sharks. Raiders are gone, but you know what I'm saying. It's been a lot of fun. We've had a lot of really talented athletes come through and a lot of really, really good teams.
It's amazing, and the San Francisco Bay Area has really enjoyed a lot of success. As you mentioned, the San Francisco Giants winning three championships in 5 years. Then you have the Golden State Warriors winning four NBA titles, but having gone to two additional NBA finals. So they've been doing phenomenal. The teams in the San Francisco Bay Area have been doing phenomenal. And when you think about building relationships and types of conversations you've had with these players, for my audience and me, talk to me about what those conversations have been like, or just what it's been like interviewing them, especially in critical pivotal moments like a playoff series.
Well, there's been a lot of them. There's been a lot of series, a lot of interviews. You know, what I take away from most of these opportunities is just a chance to get to know. Like I have had a chance to spend some time with Steve Kerr. We worked together when we were at Yahoo Sports, and obviously he's had a great run with the Warriors. Just to get a chance to deal with people, as opposed to, okay, you are the coach of XYZ. I will ask you questions about the zone defense, or, you know, whatever the case may be, X's and O's. After a while, like, I don't find that to be particularly interesting, unless. Although I will say, I probably spend more than my fair share of time texting with scouts about, hey, what do you think of this guy? What do you think of that guy? What are you, trying to find pieces that will fit into a puzzle with the Warriors or 49ers, whatever the case may be. But I just find, you know, having the ability to connect with people like Steve or Bob Myers, or, you know, if I see Chris Mullin, Tim Hardaway, Mitch Richmond, the run TMC guy, all those guys, we just kind of grew up together in a particular era. And so we have some shared experiences. And so I think that's the coolest thing.
That's awesome. And, you know, I love the synergies and the connections I can make with previous guests. I've interviewed a few people who have had ties to the Warriors or currently have ties to the Warriors. There's Larry Harris, who's the assistant general manager of the Warriors.
Yeah.
Son of Del Harris. I've interviewed both of them on my podcast, Del being the former Los Angeles Lakers NBA coach, as well as the Houston Rockets and Milwaukee Bucks Basketball Hall of Fame. Kim Stone, who worked for the Miami Heat for many years, but for a 2-year period, she was the general manager of the Chase Center. Yeah. And now she's the president of the UBS Arena up in Long Island. Then I think about having interviewed Scott Howard Cooper, who wrote a biography on Steve Kerr, who's been friends with Steve for many years. It's really cool that you talk about the Warriors so fondly, and you talk about, you know, your relationship with Steve. Here to share some of the conversations you've had with him, you know, outside of the X's and O's. I mean, he probably gives you a bird's eye view of the day and a life as an NBA coach.
You know, to be honest, we don't talk that much about that. He's actually one of the more talented people I know, and has had such an incredible life. A lot of extremes, as you know, because of, you know, his father being assassinated, but also to be able to be a part of 9 championships, 5 as a player, 4 as a coach. And I mean, it's just, you know, fun talking with him about, it's just, we both love to surf, you know, and stuff with our kids, that sort of stuff. It's really more those interactions that I find more interesting. I mean, I will say this, if you do another podcast with Larry Harris, you should ask him if he's tired of me texting him about about big guys in the draft. I'm like, this guy will work. This guy will work. He's like, no. So we have creative disagreements on who's going to turn into great players and, you know, who's not. And I have a kind of a running gag with some of my buddies at work about Jonathan Kuminga, because I didn't think Jonathan Kuminga was going to be there when he was, you know, at 7 in the draft. And I thought the Warriors were going to take Franz Wagner. And you know all about Franz Wagner, given where you're located in Orlando. And Franz Wagner is just a better player at this point. I mean, Jonathan Kuminga is terrific and a great athlete and, you know, foot over the rim and all this. But Franz knows how to play. If Franz is on the Warriors right now, they would be in a lot better shape than they are as we sit here with them down, you know, 0-2 to Sacramento.
And probably before this series started, did you ever think the Warriors would already be down 2 games to 0, or was the writing already on the wall, just given the fact that, you know, they're getting up there in age? I mean, they're still all relatively young and they still have some really good years left, but winning 4 championships out of 6 NBA Finals appearances is phenomenal. I mean, it's exceptional. But like the Bulls teams, you know, back in the 90s, or you think of any professional sport that's had their dynasties, the 49ers and the Cowboys and, you know, what have you. I mean, like, there's a level of standard that you have to meet, you know, every year. And that adds a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation. So you're probably fully aware of just what the sentiments are of people thinking like, hey, could the Warriors come back from 2-0, or is this going to be an early exit from the playoffs?
This season has been so strange, so frustrating in many ways for fans as well as those in the organization, starting with Draymond and the punch, with Jordan Poole, and just the weirdness of them being unable to win road games. We were maybe naively expecting them to be able to kind of flip a switch, because they're really at the point, and they would admit it themselves, that the regular season is just an inconvenient truth. It's 6 months that they have to endure to get to the stuff that really matters. The problem is they've developed so many bad habits over that 6-month window of the regular season. Just the careless turnovers, the mistakes, the lack of attention to detail. And yeah, it's hard to explain. I'm, you know, watched the game last night. They turned it over 22 times. A lot of them are just unforced errors with guys not paying attention and throwing the ball all over the place, cross-court passes. And I know it drives Steve crazy, Bob, the owner, Joe Lacob. I mean, everybody's just like, what are we doing? But they've, I think part of it is this weird false sense of security. Like, they have achieved so much in these four titles that they think we could dig ourselves out of any hole. Well, right. Now, you know, maybe you can, maybe you can't. And I know a lot of people talk about, well, you know, you got the core members, they're over 30 years old. Steph's 35. Steph is as good as he's ever been. He's stronger than he's ever been. You know, Klay's come back from two devastating injuries. Incredible. Draymond, what he's able to do, he's the one I would worry about the most for a variety of reasons. But from a physical standpoint, you know, he's listed at 6'7". Maybe he's, you know, 6'5¾", 6'6", and takes right. just a physical pounding. At a certain point, that adds up and, you know, you can no longer do it. So we'll see what happens. Going to be a lot of really interesting decisions with the Warriors if they go out in the first round of the Kings, because this season, if you count salary and luxury tax, there are $363 million.
Unbelievable. What a price tag.
Yeah. And it's fine. You can do that if you're winning championships. But if you're going out in the first round, you're losing all the revenue from the playoffs and the finals. It's not sustainable. And so, you know, they could be looking at some serious roster changes if this thing goes south and they don't come back in this series. I have to say, you know, getting to know Mike Brown a little bit, he was with the Warriors for 6 years. So happy for him. He's such a good guy. And I'll admit that, you know, he was a guest with us on one of our NBA Finals postgame shows, and then shortly got the Sacramento Kings job after that. And we're like, really cool for Mike, happy for Mike, you know, got another head coaching job. And then on the side, you know, we would say, oi, but it's the Kings. he's going to be back here in a couple of years because, you know, everybody fails there. No, he's really turned it around. And I got to say that, you know, the whole light the beam gimmick, it's fantastic. You know, we were out there last night shooting up in the sky with our camera phones to see if we could get the peak of the beam, the laser at the top. It was a lot of fun. It was a really cool atmosphere.
Well, I'm happy for the Sacramento Kings. I mean, when you think about those, you know, early 2000s teams, you know, competing with the Lakers in the playoffs, and you had Mike Bibby and Vlade Divac, and
yeah,
you know, you had Peja Stojakovic and Rick Adelman, you know, leading the way. I mean, Chris Webber, Doug Christie, I mean, Hedo Turkoglu. I mean, they had a squad, and if it wasn't for the Lakers, they would be NBA Finals champions. And at some point, right, at least one or two seasons. And then if you think about in the East, I mean, those two New Jersey Nets teams with Jason Kidd and Vince Carter, they would fall to the Lakers in the finals. I mean, my point is that there are really good teams that, depending on what era or what time period they're competing in, makes or breaks their chance of winning a championship. But I mean, just going back to the Sacramento Kings, I mean, it's probably the most successful team they've had since those Rick Adelman years.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, when you haven't been to the playoffs in 17 years, you know, that's how long the drought was for, this is their first appearance in 17 years since the 06 team. I mean, it wears on the fan base. And so those people, when you see them on TV, they're in a frenzy for a reason, because they have a lot of pent up emotion that comes from not being a part of the postseason for so many years. And we had that with the Warriors for the longest time. I mean, they were right there, you know, as one of the worst franchises in basketball for, you know, with the Clippers for the longest period of time. And then the change in ownership happened, you know, about a dozen years ago. And then it, you know, totally changed everything. One of the things that actually, you know, really reinforced to me is every organization, just look at the top. Just look at whoever is in a leadership position. If they're good people and they know what they're doing and they take care of their employees, you got a tremendous chance to be successful. Also, the willingness to spend to make money. And in this market, we saw the previous ownership, they were unwilling to do any of that.
Right.
They were not good with their people, not good with employees, not good with the draft, not good in just about everything. And then to see it all flip in the other direction, It's really cool. And to see all those people that have been with the organization for a long time rewarded. Conversely, I've got a bunch of friends that have worked for the Oakland A's and are just watching that thing circle the drain because the owner doesn't want to spend any money. And so it's such a stark contrast. You know, if I ever become a billionaire, which at this point is pretty unlikely, I certainly know how I would want to run things. And it would certainly be more of the way the Warriors do it than the way the A's do it.
Well, I mean, from a hypothetical standpoint, I mean, because of the podcast about relationship building in a team environment, I wanted to talk to you about the type of relationships that you have built in local news, some of the stories that you've covered. What is it about covering local news in the Bay Area that's unique to you? And we'll then get to the next question I had in mind, was that what does it take for, if you were in a type of position where you were working for a franchise, let's say, or being an executive and a leader of a franchise, what does it take to make a successful team? I mean, you can speak to me about what it takes to have a successful local station, because, you know, ABC7 is very successful. But I also want to get your feedback on what makes a team successful in your eyes, having covered many teams for many years. But I'll start my first question. What has it been like to be at ABC7 and the relationships that you've built there?
Well, it's an interesting time, not only on the business side in terms of local news, but also what's happening in many parts of the state of California and in San Francisco in particular, kind of this erosion of, I guess I would just say, humanity. And, you know, the homeless problem, the drug problem, the cost of living, the post-pandemic conditions. You know, talking with a lot of people, you talk with the mayors of these cities, trying to figure out, how do we fix some of this stuff? And, you know, because I anchor the news in addition to doing the sports, you know, on a daily basis, you know, we're having these conversations about the slogan that we have at our station, you know, building a better Bay Area. How do we do that? How do we try to make it affordable for my kids to be able to grow up and live in the state of California? And there's just so many challenges that you really see on a local level. If you, you know, if you're doing network stuff, yes, you fly in, you do a story, you fly out, and then you go on to the next thing. But we're here, you know, every day. And so you can really see some of the problems and the challenges in really addressing them through the government. It's hard. And post-pandemic, it's really hard. So there's that. And, you know, in terms of the second part of what you were asking, it really does require teamwork to be successful. And if you have weak links in the chain, you better be able to figure out how you're going to cover, you know, for those particular deficiencies. And it's the same thing, just like, you know, Steve Kerr is trying to figure out how to tighten up his defense, you know, five guys on a string. Same thing with us when we're doing TV, and, you know, the cameraman needs this, the director needs that, the producer needs this, you know, to have everybody as a team working together and then, you know, putting together a product. To me, that's really gratifying. And if, you know, you talk to people afterwards and, you know, you made them laugh, you made them smile, you gave them, you know, some fact or whatever that they can take with them just to, I mean, it sounds kind of corny, like we're enhancing lives, but just to be able to give people a break from the monotony or connect with them, because on the sports side, we're certainly all fans, otherwise we wouldn't be watching. So that there's really a bond there, you know, for me, having gone to the University of Hawaii, I mean, I still live and die with University of Hawaii football and the results. And so I die a lot.
Thankfully not literally, you just mean figuratively.
Yeah, figuratively, yeah. But it's you know, those are the bonds that you know, that will last forever. And part of it, you know, is whatever your alma mater is, you have this deep affection, you know, a lot of us do. And so I think those are the things. It's a different kind of teamwork, you know, like I'd like to see Hawaii football and the coach, Timmy Chang. I'll do anything to help them get better. If it's a Northern California recruit or, you know, whatever the case may be, or fundraising, what have you. I think all those things, you know, are, it's not necessarily defined as teamwork, but we're all kind of working with a similar goal in mind.
Of course. And, you know, I'm so glad you think highly of your alma mater. I do the same with mine. And, you know, even so many years removed from college, I mean, you know, you root for your teams and you want to see your university do well. And I want to go back to, you know, talking about the San Francisco Bay Area, just from a local news perspective. I mean, when you got to ABC7 in 2001, now we're in 2023. Yeah. When did you start seeing changes in the San Francisco Bay Area? And how much did that take a, when I say toll, I mean in this, from the standpoint of, it must have been, you know, as years have gone on, it's probably harder for someone like you in a place that you love and that you care about and that you've invested so much time in, you know, you and your family, into the community and getting to know the people. And you are a relationship builder. You're like the bridge between people at home who are relying on you and your colleagues to report the news and talking about what's happening in the San Francisco and in the Bay Area and in Oakland and surrounding communities. It must be really hard to see all these different transformations. And, you know, for someone like you in your position, probably feel like, what more can I do? I mean, what else could I do? How else could I give back to the community and make it a better place?
Yeah, that's kind of the frustrating part with all of this, is that we talk all about what the problems are. You know, we've identified the problems. We know what the problems are. It's the solutions that have been really elusive. And, you know, I look at somebody like Mark Benioff, who's the head of Salesforce, and just spends tons of money and donations to charities and trying to help clean up the homeless in San Francisco. And it just seems like it's an endless money pit. You just keep pouring. And we're not really seeing signs of discernible progress. So I think that's the biggest thing that I get frustrated with, when I see just the same things that we're unable as a society to figure out. And we have to keep talking about the same stuff because we're unable to address it effectively. And that's certainly the case at the national level. I mean, there's, you know, I don't want to get into a whole political conversation, but just the way we're split as a country in terms of views, I just think it's sad, you know, because in general, I really believe, and this kind of, you know, connects with the team building points that you were talking about. I think most of us probably have similar views on a lot of topics, mm-hmm. but, you know, we all want, you know, a cost of living where we can have a good life. We all want, you know, good lives for our kids. You want to be able to work whatever your job is, but also to be able to play and be able to afford to play and have, you know, fun and just a well-rounded life. And so I think if you were to list all the similarities we have, we probably have way more similarities than we have differences as humans. But, you know, when it comes down to it, it's all about, you know, gun control, or you're going to take my guns away. You know, it's all these polarizing things that we don't seem to be able to have civilized conversation anymore. It's mostly just screaming at each other, and a lot of that is screaming on TV, but we are not necessarily having a lot of intelligent discourse to resolve the problems that we have in our communities. And I think, to your point, that is one of the really, really frustrating things. And I wish I had more answers, or was in a position to do something about these things. But I look around with, you know, mayor, governor, whatever it is, we're still all struggling with the same issues. And, you know, back in Honolulu, the homeless problem is out of control. And, you know, there's so many things that I wish could be addressed more effectively. But I just don't know that we're making as much progress as I would like to see on really bringing people together. We've got like 330 million people in the country. And if you look at the results of elections, we seem to just be, you know, it's almost two different galaxies in terms of at least what we focus on. And maybe that's part of the media's fault as well. But I wish we had a way to come together a little bit more harmoniously instead of all the yelling and screaming that goes on every day.
When did you start seeing a change just from your professional opinion, especially covering the news, reporting the news, being at a thriving local station in the heart of one of the biggest cities in the country? Throughout history, I mean, California is known for a lot of different things, you know, movies, technology, the military has bases in California. And sports entertainment has always been a major, major platform that California gets featured in throughout its history, throughout, you know, century sports. I mean, it's phenomenal. When did you start seeing, maybe not so much California and California included, but when do you think you started seeing the changes in how discourse has or was or continues to be? When did you start seeing that change?
You know, I really think a lot of it occurred, about a decade ago, both locally and nationally, and then we had a presidential election that really divided the country. And we see that division continuing. And, I naively thought that when President Obama was elected, that we were going to like come together harmoniously as a country. And it seems like, and I don't, blame the Obamas at all, but it just, we were not able to make the progress that I think we had the potential to make as a country. And I think it just ended up in a strange way. Somehow we ended up more divided, and I did not see that coming at all. And in terms of how it's reflected in San Francisco is it's such a liberal city that we have one view in terms of whether it's gun control or abortion rights or things like that. But man, it's just the challenges that we face. And you look, I mean, I'm not even talking about globally in terms of, the warming of the planet, the plastics in the ocean. And I could list all these problems, and it sounds, you and I are never going to figure these things out, most likely. I'm hoping we can science our way out of a lot of things. And at a certain point, come to some kind of humanitarian outlook, perspective, that even though you and I may disagree on a topic, we can actually still be friends while we disagree about X, Y, or Z. And we kind of have lost that, in my view. You like that and I like this, so I'm done. I don't want to talk to you anymore. There's too much of that. We need to find a way to come together, and this, whether we can do it or not, we could just keep going the way we're going too. And who knows where that leads to, but, it would be a nice large scale goal to see us try to make some progress. And I'm not sure which way we're going on that. The pendulum goes both ways, and hopefully it swings back to something that's a little bit more moderate. Where the other part of it is, and I'm sure you see a lot of this, doing these podcasts, is just the polarization that, people have really hardened views and can't seem to accept anything other than this is the way I see it. And it's the only way it's going to be seen. So hopefully we can make some progress over time.
Well, it's interesting because, I've said in recent times that, relationship building is the essence of humanity. And that's in the most idyllic ways to think about it. I mean, from an idealism perspective, if you will, relationship building is the essence of humanity. And when we are rowing the right direction or the same direction and we are on the same page, I mean, a lot of wonderful, amazing things can happen amongst the human populations in this country or around the world. But, you know, when we're at odds with each other, I mean, there's a lot of gridlock and there's a lot of frustration and anger and consternation that, like you said, you know, you would never have imagined it getting this bad. I mean, if you're going back maybe 10 years or so, why do you think, just from your perspective, why is relationship building, what are the challenges? Why is it so hard to implement in a lot of ways when it, in concept, it seems so simple, it seems easy to execute, but in reality, it's not.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to give you a great answer on that. I do think one of the problems that we have is social media has magnified and amplified a lot of messages, not necessarily in a good way. And I think we have become so reactionary in terms of the way we deal with news on a daily basis that, you know, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, and all of, that's a, we could do a whole podcast just on Facebook, but I think it's made us worse as a society. It just really has. You know, I still, you talk about the potential of so many things. The ability to instantly communicate news around the globe is unbelievable. I mean, the technology that we have now, you know, the ability to instantaneously get access to almost any fact. And now with AI, I mean, you can do almost anything. Yet, the messages that seem to get the most amplification on all of our social media platforms are the most negative ones, the most polarizing ones. And it just adds to the divisions that we have as opposed to bringing more people together. And I don't know how, you know, you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle at this point. We have to figure out ways to manage it. And, you know, you look at kids and self-image and, you know, they see all the doctored photos of their favorite people and feeling that they can't ever achieve those things. And so, yeah, we have all this cool stuff and technology and big screens and this and that, and we could do, you know, fly rockets to Mars and get all these cool pictures and things. But on a basic level, I think we're missing a lot of the important stuff. It's just going right by us because we're too busy staring at the phone or too busy reacting to something that's been posted on social media. So I actually try to, you know, consciously underreact to a lot of things because I just don't know that it's really healthy. And certainly, you know, when you're in the public eye, I mean, I could go to Twitter on any given day and find somebody that is convinced I'm an idiot and we'll give you 10 reasons why. But rather than reacting to all these people and getting in fights, I have some friends in the media. All they want to do is just fight with all these people all the time. I just look at it and go, what a waste of energy. I don't have that much energy to I want to put out positive energy, not just all this bickering and stuff. And I don't even remember what the question was, actually. I'm just kind of on a rant here, but...
No worries. I was going to say there's not enough time in the day to engage in, for people to engage in negative discourse. I mean, you got to use your hours wisely to, you know, put out a lot of positive and uplifting and healthy messaging. And you're in a position where at a local station, do your colleagues and the people that you work with at your station, what are their takes? I mean, and obviously you're most likely echoing the sentiments that I'm sure they have, but, you know, I've interned at local stations before. I've never formally worked at a local station. But I've been around them enough to know that I'm sure when it comes to like social media and maybe how they want to utilize that platform when it comes to reporting the news. I mean, everything's instantaneous, but what is your station's, I think, position when it comes to social media and utilizing those platforms to be able to not, obviously local news does a much, much better job than the networks in terms of sometimes sensationalizing the news. I mean, I feel like local news really is pretty objective. I mean, there's some subjectivity. I mean, if there's some, you know, sure, back and forth talking and giving, you know, some subjective viewpoints, but what do you think from your perspective, how your station, what's their messaging, what's their policy when it comes to social media and how you want to engage with your viewers in the Bay Area?
You know, it's really changed through the years. I think early on with the emergence of Facebook, there was certainly an emphasis to try to be on the platform a lot. And, you know, the one message always is to try to put more positivity into the universe and to try to get people to watch stories that, you know, we think will help them in their day-to-day lives. It's changed just because some of these platforms, I think the more we've learned, the less we want to be on them. And certainly all that's going on with Twitter nowadays, it's just, it comes back to the whole divisiveness thing, you know? So there's a lot of news organizations that don't even want to be on Twitter anymore, and people that are really pulling back. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing that we re-examine social media with, you know, again, the station slogan is building a better Bay Area, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge when so many of the messages that people receive are negative and openly trying to split communities and things like that. And certainly, look, you know, there's enough bad things going on that we don't need to amplify them. It'd be nice if we could try to come together. And, you know, it goes back to, you know, what we started talking about in the beginning, which, you know, how do you build relationships that are positive, not just, you know, where, okay, this is my arch rival, my adversary, you know, what have you. It's getting harder and harder, it seems, to do that, largely because of the influence of social media, I think.
Of course, and I wish there was a way that people like you and me and a lot of other people who, again, they don't necessarily have to agree. We're in a society where we can agree to disagree, and that's okay, but yep, the way the media portrays it, it's one network might have this overall viewpoint and the other network might have that overall viewpoint. And I think that's where all the division comes from, is that people are choosing sides of where they want to get their media and where they want to, and they identify with certain messaging and maybe certain individuals who are projecting that information, or there's always some type of angle or there's always some type of agenda. And we have journalism degrees, right? And you know, we remember, I read this and I've talked to, you know, having conversations with my parents or just reading in history books, not to age you, but I mean, you are older than me. So you remember even more of those traditional decades of true journalism. Oh, yeah. And it must be mind-boggling and frustrating for you to see that, wow, you know, 2023 is probably much different, right, than 1983 or 1973. So even 1993, I mean, even the early 90s, right, even before you joined ESPN. So how difficult has that been for you to see every decade? It seems like maybe, you know, in some ways, yes, we're making progress, whether it's curing cancers or having more people in tune with what's happening with the environment and making sure that we're taking care of our environment. But then again, you see that there are a lot of people who are deniers of global climate change.
Yeah.
And then you're right, exactly right. You bring up people who are pro Second Amendment. A lot of people are saying that they don't want people's guns to be taken away. They just don't want to see these, you know, mass casualties, these mass shootings in our society. So to your point, I feel like a lot of people want the same things. I just think that the messaging is lost. And, you know, you and I know it very well that communication is everything. So it's almost like the media is not living by that one simple rule that communication is everything. It's breaking down, and they're relying probably on the viewers at home to figure out, you know, one way or the other, what's objective and what's subjective. But we know that there are certain segments of the population that are just more informed and more educated just by virtue of location or just resources and just where academics were championed, where in other places academics weren't, you know, possibility. So I kind of feel that it's probably problematic. When I say problematic, it is problematic, but it's challenging for people like us to not be able to do more when we see, you know, just how media is being received.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you touched on that I think is really important for people to understand is, you know, it used to be, I mean, if you really go back a number of years to the Walter Cronkites in the business, news was never seen as a place that was supposed to be the profit center of a network. And that has changed through the years. And now that's all that anybody cares about. And it's to our detriment, because if it's better for Fox to take a position of conservatism and just hammer that message regardless of whatever the facts may be, and you take another network on the other side and, okay, we're going to be the liberal side and we're just going to hammer that because it's the road to profitability. It's greed. And we've lost kind of what our mission is. And I remember, you know, having a boss that was kind of like the Walter Cronkite of Hawaii. And it was just like, right down the middle, just tell the story. You don't need to take sides. You don't have to yell and scream. In fact, his rule was, I never want to hear the word I in a story coming out of your mouth. It's not about you. You have nothing to do with you. You are the reporter. Stay the hell out of it. And we're so far away from that now. And I think it's mostly because of greed. People see that they can make more money doing it this way as opposed to that way. And so everybody's down that road. And I think all the networks are guilty of it. Everybody's, you know, publicly traded companies. All that anybody cares about is quarterly profits. How did we do? How do we, you know? So if that's what's driving all of your decision-making, it's hard to make good long-term decisions, long-term planning. Because all you're focused on is, I got to hit my number in March. You know, the first quarter's got to, I got to be here. And, It's certainly not to our benefit to have all of these systems in place that this is the way we're going to operate. I mean, okay, look, you know, are we going to be Pollyannish about it and say, well, it doesn't matter if anybody makes a profit. Okay, you know, we can all coexist and we'll hold hands. That's not realistic either. But we have to find some healthier middle ground where everybody can thrive. Maybe you're not going to make as much as you want to make, but does it matter to do the greater good anymore? I'm not sure that that's even a mission statement of any of these companies anymore. And until we get back to that, it's, you know, it's going to be hard to fix a lot of the problems that we have.
Well, I just hope that for our society's sake and for the sake of our world, that we can see better times and we can see, you know, real change. Quantifiable change that could be really, that people can follow, that people can understand, that people could rally around. You know, not for the word change to be just thrown around loosely, that whether at the local, state, or federal level, you know, and there are great leaders in all three, local, state, and federal. But at the same time, people still want to feel as a whole that they're being represented. And they are 330 plus million Americans. They are represented. But at the same time, you're not going to make everybody happy, unfortunately.
Right.
And everybody's going to still feel pressures here, stress here, stress there, pressure there, where have you. But I just hope that we do reach a pivotal point in society where the pendulum swings in a favorable light, and that we start adopting things from the past that worked for our society. And it may sound very idealistic, but I really just hope for the best.
I think we have a crisis of leadership. I think that's a big problem. And, you know, there was a time where we had more. I'm not a huge fan of the way our political process has played out, because I think for a lot of politicians, the goal is to get elected. And then the next goal is to get elected in four more years or whatever it is. And it's all just this cycle of getting reelected. It has nothing to do with what your service is to your community. And the system is set up. It's inherently designed to create a situation where the individual politicians are looking out more for their own political survival than doing the right thing. And, you know, we could certainly talk about that when it comes to, you know, the gun situation in this country. And look, do you want to be able to send your kids to school and not have to worry about them getting shot by some crazy person? I mean, I think we go 100 out of 100 on that, right? Like, you know, yet we can't make any progress. So, you know, I think we really need better leadership. And it's a challenging time to try to develop those leaders, given all the things that we've talked about, you know, in the past hour or so.
And, you know, when you think about, you know, you have two daughters, and, you know, when you think about your family, and what are, if you can put it in, let's say, three or five action words, like, in your mind, what does it take to be a successful relationship builder in any type of environment? In a school, in a company, in a family, in a news station, I mean, a sports team, like what really matters to you as a relationship builder?
If you have a focus on empathy and compassion and try to look at things from somebody else's perspective and not just react to whatever your initial emotion may be, I think that's really key. And again, it comes back to leadership. I think if we can look at a group of people that we may not agree with entirely, but we can see what the greater good is. We could see what, you know, just thinking about others and not just trying to be the loudest person in the room. I think that's important to try to build long lasting relationships and make progress, as you know, because, you know, I tell some of our production assistants and our interns, you know, we're only here, this is one ride. You get one ride, you know, and when it's over, it's done. So make the most of your opportunities, make the most of your relationships, develop good contacts with people that you like and feel you can trust. And that's really it. It's actually not that complicated. You know, the cavemen had to figure out, how do we deal with the woolly mammoth? You know, we have to come together. One of us is not going to beat them, you know, but maybe as a village, as a tribe, maybe we could get this, you know, get this done. So I think that, you know, even going back to, you know, however many thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, whatever it is, I think it's the same thing. It really is the same thing. It's like, how can we get together to make things better for all of our people around us? What's a simple way to do that? And me screaming at you or you screaming at me probably doesn't advance that cause very much. So just understanding that, because unfortunately, you know, the way it is now, the flashiest or the loudest, or the most abrasive, those are the people who get most of the attention. That's the way we've set it up with well, you know, a lot of our large media companies. Because that's what gets clicks, that's what gets attention, that's what gets eyeballs. It's all about that. And we don't really think about the long term as much.
And I'm sure these are the same messages with your daughters, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the time. We talk about it a lot. They're in a pretty good shape, though. They've got good heads on their shoulders. And, you know, so that's something that I am happy about. But, you know, when you look at the day to day, it's a crazy world. So I probably spend more time worrying about them than I should, but that's kind of where we are right now.
Of course, of course. Well, I wanted to switch gears before we depart from our interview. I know that you were featured on This Is SportsCenter commercial. And what was that like to be a part of an iconic series of commercials that ESPN was known to, or has known to feature? And you were in the same commercial with Michael Buffer. So I thought that was pretty remarkable. I wanted to ask you that in the earlier part of our interview, but I wanted to also talk about, because you're in local news and, you know, it's not just sports, it's all about current events. And I'm glad we touched upon some politics as well, because I always love getting people's perspectives and having a healthy discourse. So everybody loves, you know, those SportsCenter commercials. So how are you chosen for that? And, you know, what was it like interacting with Michael Buffer?
You know, how any of us were chosen for any of them is pretty random, to be honest. Like, I don't know who decided or what they came up with, or, you know, I should be in this, or, you know, I actually did a bunch of them, but the only one that people really remember is the Michael Buffer spot. In fact, I did a segment, you know, involving the Warriors on the NBA Today on ESPN last week. And so Malika Andrews was the host, and they played the Michael Buffer spot. And I was like, it's so funny. It's like so many years later, 20 something years later, and we're still, it still kind of has legs. But so the cool thing to come back to, like, to what we started with and all this, I saw Michael at the NBA Finals. I'm trying to remember which year it was. I can't even, you know, it's like pre-pandemic, post-pandemic. I don't even know where we are anymore. Well, the last time I saw him was he was doing the introductions for the NBA Finals, and I saw him backstage, and it was like, it was just like we were back in this, in the lobby of ESPN. And I think we only did like three or four takes of that. And we had the smoke machine and the disco lights and the phones and this and that. And, you know, I tell you what, the production on those was phenomenal. The behind the scenes on that stuff was unbelievable. So it was a privilege just to be involved and to still have people, you know, remembering what we did back then. But Michael's, you know what? He's a great guy, and he has the greatest gig of all. You know, you show up and you go, let's get ready to rumble. People go berserk and everybody's happy to see you. And then you hop on the plane and go do it again, you know, thousands of miles away. So he's a good guy. He's had a great career, and it's just, it's fun every time I see him.
That's amazing. And I'm so glad that you have those memories, that you could reconnect with him in recent years.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that you've had a lot of conversations with either coaches or players, or when you're in a position like we are in the media, or even for someone like you in the day to day, getting to work in local news and having worked at Sports Network News, I mean, you come across a lot of people, and, you know, you have impacted all those people in some way, shape, or form. People you meet and people you don't meet, because you're not going to be able to meet everybody who is watching you local TV. And even when you were on SportsCenter and at ESPN, you're not going to meet every person who has ever, you know, watched you on ESPN. But you know that when you give 110% to your craft every day like you have, you know that people got to see like the best of your work at any given moment. And that should give you gratification, knowing that, hey, I made a difference. You know, I represent a product really well. I was a part of ESPN. I've been a part of ABC7. I'm an alumnus of the University of Hawaii. Like, it must give you satisfaction and gratification in your career at this stage in your career, when you can look back on those fond memories. You know, you're a father to your daughters. I've interviewed so many people like you who have done phenomenal things personally and professionally. And, you know, that's what I love about the speaker series, because relationship building, as I said, is the essence of humanity. And it really allows us to speak, you know, so openly and candidly about why it matters and the things that make, what makes relationship building work. And hey, we're human. Human beings are not perfect, but you know, that we hope to see more relationship building our society and being in more of a, in the fabric of our society.
Yeah. I think, you know, along the lines of what you're talking about there, the fact that at any given moment, Kenny Mayne can text me about something that he's involved with and go, hey, can you help me out with this? Or I may text Neil Everett and say, hey, can you take a look at this? People that, or Keith, or, you know, I could go down the list of all the names of people, but just the fact that here we are decades later, we still actually all like each other and want to see the best for one another. And those relationships, you know, that's really what it's all about. You know, you just be a good person, do good things, and try to help one another. That's all we can do while we're here. You know, like I said, you get one ride, try to make it a good ride. You know, you don't have to denigrate somebody else's ride to make your ride look better. You know, just, you know, let's just all get along. Can't we all just get along? Let's try.
And on that note, I think that's great, great words of wisdom. And I really want to thank you so much, Larry, for, you know, spending the time over an hour with me talking about relationship building and team environment. We touch a lot of different categories. And I just loved how the conversation progressed in a lot of different areas and really enjoyed our conversation. And I know my audience will as well. And thank you again for being guests on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. Thank you so much again.
No, thank you for inviting me, and you know, to be continued, and go Magic since you're in Orlando. Going to get another good draft pick pretty soon.
I pray that we do, and I really appreciate that. And coming from a, you know, I do root for the Warriors too, and I'm so happy to see and hear of their success and over the years, and I really appreciate that. I know that the Magic, you know, they have another NBA Finals and eventually, hopefully, an NBA championship in their future. But yeah, let's definitely stay in touch. I look forward to future conversations, and let me know how I could ever be of assistance.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you so much for your time. You take care, and we'll talk soon.